years after the landmark Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion, what is the state of reproductive rights in the U.S.? The candidates vying for the Republican presidential nomination have never embraced such extreme positions on abortion, with no exceptions for rape and incest. Last night, Personhood USA held its first ever pro-life forum. Last year, states enacted a record number of abortion restrictions. We're now talking about the possibility of banning birth control in the year 2012. So how did we get here, and what should the response be? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Zoe Diamond. The governor of Texas, Rick Perry, has pulled out of the race to become the Republican Party's candidate in the US presidential election this November. He made the announcement to supporters in the state of South Carolina.
I have come to the conclusion that there is no viable path forward for me in this 2012 campaign. Therefore, today, I am suspending my campaign and endorsing Newt Gingrich for President of the United States. I believe Newt is a conservative visionary who can transform our country.
Rick Perry was a highly regarded contender early in the campaign for the Republican nomination, but as Johnny Diamond reports from Washington, he'll probably be best remembered for a gaffe.
As a Texan, I've never shied away from a fight, said Governor Perry, but I know when it's time to make a strategic retreat. The governor of a big, booming state was expected to do well in the race for the Republican nomination, but on the national stage he failed to shine, with weak organisation and poor public performances. One moment, in a televised debate, when he forgot the name of one of the three government departments that he said he planned to abolish, will go down in campaign history.
The American state of Iowa has delivered a shock to the front-running Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney. The certified tally of votes from the Iowa caucuses 2 weeks ago shows that Mr. Romney was narrowly beaten by his rival Rick Santorum, not the other way round as announced at the time. But a final winner won't be declared because some uncounted votes were mislaid, and the margin between the two men is still too close to discount them. The American photographic business Eastman Kodak has filed for bankruptcy protection in New York. Founded in the late 19th century, Kodak became a universal brand. It invented the handheld camera and brought photography to the masses. But industry analyst Rupert Goodwin says that it was slow to embrace the shift to modern technologies.
The interesting thing is they saw it coming. This wasn't the case of a company that didn't know what hit it. Now, they built the first digital camera in 1975. You know, they knew what was happening, but they didn't have the guts to move with it. They had such a good business, they couldn't face up to eviscerating their own business to survive.
A BBC correspondent says Kodak hopes to emerge from bankruptcy next year. The News International Media Group has agreed to pay compensation to 37 people, including celebrities, sportsmen and politicians, whose phones were hacked by some of its journalists. They include the actor Jude Law, the footballer Ashley Cole and the former British Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott. They are among 60 people who have sued the company. The scandal over hacking by journalists at the News of the World led to a public outcry, the closure of the paper and an inquiry into media ethics. This is the latest world news from the BBC. A bomb has exploded in a crowded refugee camp in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. UN officials say six people were killed. The blast happened shortly after a group of United Nations officials and international journalists had visited the area. Earlier, the aid group Médecins Sans Frontières said that it was closing two of its medical centres in Mogadishu following the killing of two MSF workers last month. The Burmese government has held peace talks with ethnic rebels to try to end a conflict that's seen as an obstacle to the lifting of Western sanctions. The 2 days of talks were held across the border in China near the scene of fighting between government troops and ethnic Kachin rebels. Tens of thousands of civilians have fled since a truce broke down in June. An audio tape released in Italy has revealed how a crew member of the Concordia cruise ship reassured Coast Guards that there was no emergency shortly after it hit rocks. 11 people are known to have died in the disaster and more than 20 are missing. Alan Johnson reports from the island of Giglio.
This call appears to have been made about half an hour after the cruise ship struck a reef just off the coast here. Port officials have heard reports that the ship is in trouble and they ask what's going on. The crewman on the phone repeatedly says that there is an electrical problem, but he makes no reference to there having been a collision. The sense you get is that the crewman failed to give a full account of the gravity of the situation.
Experts in Switzerland have postponed for 3 years a decision on whether to abolish the leap second. Leap seconds are occasional one-second adjustments to the world's time that keep clocks synchronised with the rotation of the Earth. The United States, Germany and France want to abolish them, saying that they create problems for services that need a continuous timescale, such as the internet. That's the latest world news from the BBC.
Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As we approach the 39th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision recognizing a woman's constitutional right to have a safe and legal abortion, we are taking a look at the state of reproductive rights in the U.S. Here's what we're currently facing. Three of the four men vying for the Republican presidential nomination, Ron Paul, Newt Gingrich, and Rick Santorum, all believe abortion should be illegal, even in cases of rape, incest, and threats to a woman's health. Rick Perry just dropped out of the race, but he also holds that position. No exceptions for rape and incest is in the Republican platform, but this is the first time the major candidates have embraced such an extreme position. These men have also signed Personhood USA's first ever so-called Personhood Pledge, promising to support a, quote, human life amendment to the Constitution and endorse legislation to make clear that the 14th Amendment protections apply to unborn children. Personhood USA held its first ever pro-life forum last night in South Carolina. Rick Perry, Ron Paul, Newt Gingrich, and Rick Santorum all answered questions. And then last year, states enacted a record number of abortion restrictions. Texas law now requires doctors to provide a sonogram to women before they get an abortion. And we're debating whether or not birth control should be illegal in the year 2012. A lot of people are asking, how did we get here and what should the response be? Jody Jacobson is a reproductive justice advocate and editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check. She writes about these issues on a regular basis. That's a website that provides news and commentary on reproductive health issues. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
We are also joined by Merle Hoffman, founder of the Choices Women's Medical Clinic, one of the country's largest and most comprehensive women's medical facilities. Merle is also publisher and editor-in-chief of On the Issues magazine. That's a progressive feminist quarterly. They also have a website. She was co-founder of the National Abortion Federation, a professional association of abortion providers, and founder of the New York Pro-Choice Coalition. Merle's out with a new book called Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. And Merle joins us from New York. Hi, Merle. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have both of you. And, you know, doing this research, there's so much bad news to report. And we'll definitely talk about that on the show. But as we approach the 39th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, I'm wondering if you have anything positive to report. Jody, let's start off with you. You follow these issues closely. Is anything positive happening in the country on reproductive justice issues?
Well, I think there's two things that are positive, or one at least sort of positive. One is that, you know, I think people are waking up. What happened in Mississippi, for example, with the defeat of the Personhood Amendment in Mississippi was a testament to really grassroots efforts by women and men who were concerned about the wide-ranging assault on their choice in childbearing in that state, a very conservative state. And I think that was a very positive outcome, because I think it also helps pave the way for fighting these personhood initiatives, or as I call them, AGIS people initiatives in other states. I think the second positive thing, which may seem odd to say, is that the real agenda of the far right is finally being revealed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, they always talk about quote-unquote abortion, but or their so-called pro-life stances, but you know, really, they're coming after contraception. And as we've heard from Rick Santorum, they're coming after women's ability to operate outside the home sphere. They don't think women should be in leadership positions. They have an agenda that goes far beyond whether or not a woman terminates a pregnancy to what really is women's role in society. And the more that they reveal that, I believe the more positive it is for ensuring the protection of rights.
And we'll actually be joined by Lori Gregory Garrett later in the show, who worked on defeating the personhood amendment in Mississippi. She'll be joining us later in the show. What about you, Merle? What do you see that's positive happening on this front?
Well, I understand what you're saying, Jody, and in a sense I'm chuckling because it's almost like making lemons out of lemonade. It's good that we wake up in Mississippi, but in my mind we should have woken up in 1976 when Henry Hyde first cut off Medicaid funding. And that, to me, was the first salvo because it was against the poor and the young and the disenfranchised. And they've been getting, the anti-choice has been getting more and more virulent and more relentless. And you're absolutely correct that their generic, their prime agenda is power. And I've always believed that the abortion decision is ultimately about that. It is about power. And the idea that women would take that power of production, of reproduction, and use it and want it is very, very disconcerting for a philosophy and a mindset that believes God is on top and then man is in the family and then the woman is underneath, that hierarchical traditional concept of tradition. So it's a tremendous threat, and they have been very successful. If they don't make abortion illegal, they are very close to making it impossible for a great many women. Mm.
Well, and we will elaborate on that later in the show. But first, I'd like to welcome Kristen Ekstrand to the show. Kristen is a student at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine and a member of Medical Students for Choice. This is an organization that stands up in the face of violent opposition, working to destigmatize abortion provisions among medical students and residents, and to persuade medical schools and residency programs to include abortion as a part of the reproductive health services curriculum. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So before we dive in and really talk about what is happening at the state level and the rhetoric that we're hearing from these presidential candidates, what are you seeing out there right now as we mark the 39th anniversary of Roe v. Wade? Anything positive?
I think what you actually see within the medical school area, and then particularly within health organizations themselves, is that in the face of all this opposition, a number of medical students are now taking it upon themselves to optionally add information to their curriculum and educate their peers and get their peers involved in activism at the medical school level.
Can you elaborate on that? This is not a topic that we hear much about. I mean, what does this look like in medical schools?
So a lot of times in terms of what is actually supposed to be in the curriculum or what individuals might think should be in their curriculum, specifically whether or not their physicians are being educated with respect to contraception itself. And what you find is that not all physicians are being educated about the action of contraception and how it should be dispensed to individuals. The things that we think about in terms of personalized care for patients that come in, there are a number of barriers in terms of getting this information to students. And so students who are educated or very passionate about these issues are working with either physicians on campus who are passionate about the issue or bringing in outside speakers to try and supplement the standard curriculum with this information and holding things such as contraception workshops so students become familiar with talking about issues like safe sex with their patients and these opportunities that we are missing in our standard curriculum.
And talk a little bit about what you're hearing from other students on this issue, because when Dr. George Tiller was assassinated in 2009 in Kansas, this issue got a lot more attention, just about how dangerous it is to provide abortions. And we're seeing regular firebombs at clinics, and we'll talk about that today also. What are your fellow students think about these issues? And how do you ultimately make the decision to say, I'm going to provide abortions?
I think that's a very good question. And honestly, what I hear from other students is really this attitude of apathy, or it is hidden, things that we don't talk about unless someone who is very passionate about the issue brings them up. So I remember when George Tiller was murdered, it was something that affected me a great deal. But we actually didn't even talk about it within the medical school. And I talked about it with my friends, but people who I knew were aware of these issues. So a lot of times students aren't familiar with the issue itself, don't know or understand the need, and as a result of the fact that it isn't addressed in the curriculum, don't even know their opportunities for training or why this should be a right for women. And then when we think about abortion itself and the dangers that physicians face, this is certainly a barrier for people to get training. Because it isn't a part of the standard curriculum, students have to go out of their way to say, this is something that I want to learn. This is something that is a part of personalized care. This is something that is a part of preventative medicine, my ability to prevent unplanned pregnancies and produce healthy pregnancies. These are things that students have to make a commitment to very early on in their career to get the training that is not being provided to them. And that is a very challenging thing for most students, and usually only those who are very passionate about the issue and recognize the need go out of their way to get that training.
And let's step back here and talk about these larger issues and what we're facing right now. You've got three of the four men vying for the Republican presidential nomination, Ron Paul, Newt Gingrich, and Rick Santorum, and Rick Perry before he just dropped out of the race. And they believe that abortion should be illegal, even in cases of rape, incest, and threats to a woman's health. Jody Jacobson, how significant is this? Because I remember when John McCain was running, he believes in a constitutional amendment to overturn Roe, but he did not embrace this position. In fact, he tried to get the Republicans to take the exceptions. He wanted them to include exceptions for rape and incest in the platform. He ultimately decided to back off because there was so much pressure. But never before have Republican nominees taken this position, saying that abortion should be illegal, even in cases of rape and incest. How significant is this?
I think it's profoundly significant, and I think, again, it goes back to the strategy that's been used by the far right for over two decades now. The very furthest right has always wanted to eliminate access to abortion and contraception. They just didn't speak about it in quite these ways. They would pick out things like the non-existent partial birth abortion and then make a case out of that and divert attention. Now it's become, you know, we've gotten to the point where it's become so acceptable to marginalize women that and sort of to adopt these fundamentalist views of women as, you know, even going so far as to die for their child in utero, so to speak, that it should be allowed to, you know, force women to carry pregnancies to term, even in cases of rape or incest. And, you know, let's face it, when we're talking about incest, we're not really often talking about women. We're often talking about children. Mm. So, you know, it's part and parcel of what I believe is a deeply misogynistic basis, a fundamentalist belief system that is really becoming more and more aggressively public, not only here in the United States, but elsewhere in the world, and is just becoming more and more acceptable because the right has made it more acceptable. And now that presidential candidates want to win at any cost, they feel they have to kowtow to that extremist right.
And Merle, what would you add to that?
Well, I would add that it's not only the assertive aggression and proactivity of the anti-choice forces, but it's the fact that the pro-choice forces have not drawn a line
right
in the sand.
Right.
And this is what's most problematic. I mean, the recent override by Sibelius of the FDA ruling on Plan B is a prime example. And, you know, the movement, we consistently talk about reason and common ground and compromise. But there really is no compromise with these people. And I would like to see the pro-choice movement become far more proactive, creative, and stronger in saying this far and no further. And when a political party, i.e. the Democrats, feels that they have a constituency so tied up that whatever they do, whatever compromise they make, we have no place to go, then that's where we're going to be, absolutely nowhere. So it's incumbent upon pro-choice forces, the activists and the institutions and the physicians and the students, medical students for choice is such an extraordinarily important organization, to really come out very strongly on this and make those lines in the sand and hold them.
And Merle, for listeners who aren't familiar with what happened when HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius decided to overrule the FDA on Plan B, can you just give us a synopsis on that?
Yeah, well, Plan B is the morning after pill, and it was an issue of whether young women, 17 or younger, could take it without a prescription, without having to go to the doctor, and the FDA did say it was perfectly fine. It was not dangerous. It was not risky. And that would mean that young women can go into a drugstore and get Plan B and try to attempt to prevent an unwanted pregnancy without having to be forced to go to a doctor to get a prescription. And the Obama administration overruled that and said, no, they should. We think that it's still a risk to the child's health to go into a drugstore to try and prevent pregnancy without a physician's prescription. But, you know, one doesn't have to have a prescription to get pregnant at 11 or 12 years old and have a child. It's the thinking is illogical, totally
now,
illogical.
If I could also add to that, Rose, I don't know if this is okay, but,
sure.
You know, less than 1% of 11-year-olds are sexually active. So that was a red herring to begin with that Sebelius threw out there and the president confirmed. And
yes,
also just
confirmed, right. And
yeah.
He also, Obama said something that we have to realize that the right to reproductive freedom, the right to abortion, is not only about women's freedom. Well, I don't realize that because, for me, it is. It is a profoundly transcendent moral and human right. And no elected official is going to define what my human rights are in that way for me. But there wasn't an outcry after he said that. Nothing.
Jody, where was the outcry?
Well, I mean, I cried out.
I know
what she's saying. I mean, I think there were a group of us that did, in fact, make very strong statements about this. But but Merle is correct that, you know, we even had otherwise vociferously pro-woman, pro-choice representatives like Gwen Moore saying, I quote, "Well, the president didn't throw us entirely under the bus with this one." And my question was, how many pieces of you need to go under the bus before?
Well, I'd love to get listeners in on this. As we mark the 39th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, how do you assess where we are right now? How did we get here, and what should the response be? You've got, and we'll talk about this on today's show, the Guttmacher Institute just came out with a report finding that states enacted a record number of abortion restrictions in the year 2011. In the 50 states combined, legislators introduced more than 1,100 reproductive health and rights-related provisions, a sharp increase from 2010. 135 of them have been enacted in 36 states. And then you've got Personhood USA. Their personhood amendment did not pass in Mississippi. It lost twice in Colorado, but they're planning to reintroduce it in many states this year. So how did we get here? How are we talking about whether birth control should be legal in the year 2012? What should the response be? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our new website, yourcallradio.org. And we actually prefer that you leave a comment because other people can read it also. And or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check. Merle Hoffman is out with a memoir called Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. And Kristen Ekstrand is a member of Medical Students for Choice. And Merle, You've seen so much since the 70s, and you write about it in your book. How do you explain how we really got here? How does what we're dealing with today compare with what you saw in the 70s?
You know, sometimes I feel like I'm in that movie Groundhog Day, you know? I wake up and I'm hearing the same arguments, but it's 40 years later. You know, in the 70s, the first patient that came to, I opened Choices in 71, 2 years before Roe, and the first patient that came to us was from New Jersey because abortion was illegal in that state. And she was married with one child, but she had to have her abortion because of economic pressures. And now what I see is a landscape where the country will be split up into what I call free and slave states, and women will once again have to travel to states like New York, California, two or three others, where abortion will be legal and safe, and otherwise they'll be forced into unsafe later or abortions or even dangerous, life-threatening or fatal abortions. So we got here in a lot of different ways. I think I addressed it in the beginning of my comments, the holding back from coming out so strongly at the first salvo, which was Hyde. The lack of formulating strong enough coalitions with other progressive groups throughout the years. The individual feeling of so many women, and you know, one out of three American women do have abortion, so it's almost a ubiquitous event in this country. Yet, but the feeling of so many women that there is still shame and discomfort and the inability to own it and say, yes, I have had abortion and I want to help protect that right. So all of these things play into a less than active and proactive movement. Well, and then, of course, there's the institutionalization of the large organizations now, NARAL, Pro-Choice, and Planned Parenthood, who have been there for years and are bulwarks against some of this, but yet are not agile enough to move quickly enough against the consistent hydra of the attacks that the anti-choice movement is always putting up. Mm. So we have to be more creative. We have to engage with the young people a lot deeper and a lot stronger.
Well, we have a number of calls, so let's take a few before we go to break. Let's hear from Lauren in San Francisco. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to say that I'm a member of Nursing Students for Choice at UCSF, and actually one of the things that we're trying to do now is create a very strong coalition with Medical Students for Choice. We love what Medical Students for Choice is doing. And we also recognize the importance that advanced practice clinicians, including nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, are also involved because they're actually more likely to encounter women when they have an unplanned pregnancy. And also because this is reproductive health, this is something that we all need to work together to promote. And actually, nurse practitioners are performing, and advanced practice clinicians are performing early first trimester abortions actively in at least two states right now. And one of the pushes that there is to expand the scope of practice in other states so that they are able to meet women's health care needs when they come in with an unplanned pregnancy or an unwanted pregnancy, and be able to provide them with care.
And Lauren, just quickly, we only have about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
What strategies are you using? Where do you think this needs to go to reach out to more young women?
I think we have what some people can call a diversity of tactics. The strategies that we're using are just at every opportunity, collaborating with medical students. We talk to our patients. We speak at rallies. There's a rally going on in San Francisco this Saturday. We work with a group of reproductive health professionals at Advancing New Standards for Reproductive Health, which is part of UCSF. We collaborate at the national level. There's a diversity of things going on, and definitely progress is being made.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Lauren. And the rally she just mentioned is taking place at Justin Herman Plaza in San Francisco this Saturday at 11 o'clock. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment there about today's topic, or you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. How did we get here, and where are we going? What do you think the strategies should be? What would actually work? You can also give us a call, 866-798-8255. We'll be back after this.
If you're a fan of Facebook, become a fan of KALW. It's an easy thing to do. Just to spread the word about the programming you value on local public radio, just click the Facebook link on the front page of KALW.org. And thanks.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave comments there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we'll talk about coverage of taxes and ongoing budget cuts in California. We'll also discuss coverage of President Obama saying no for now to the Keystone Pipeline and the mass protests in Nigeria. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the current state of reproductive rights in the United States as we approach the 39th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision recognizing a woman's constitutional right to have a safe and legal abortion. Three of the four men vying for the Republican presidential nomination, Ron Paul, Newt Gingrich, and Rick Santorum, believe abortion should be illegal even in cases of rape and incest. They've also signed Personhood USA's first ever personhood pledge, promising to support a, quote, human life amendment to the Constitution. Personhood USA held their first ever pro-life forum last night in South Carolina, although no questions were asked about children who are actually living. It was all about when they think life begins and if they would pass an amendment to the Constitution. Last year, states enacted a record number of abortion restrictions. So today we're talking about how we got here, and what should the response to this be? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, Merle Hoffman. She's out with a new memoir about her many years standing up for reproductive justice, Intimate Wars, the Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion Back from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. And Kristen Ekstrand is a member of Medical Students for Choice. And let's go through a few calls, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Melody in Alameda. Hi, Melody.
Hi there. My question is, why do a group of male politicians get to decide whether we should have the right to a safe abortion or contraception? We don't have to look too far to see many of them who were unfaithful to their wives and produced children with other women. And I would particularly emphasize looking back to Margaret Sanger and her efforts to just get basic contraceptive information out there and spent time in jail. And this is just a continuing misogynistic attitude of these men, and I'm really getting tired of the same old, using this issue as a political football.
What should the response be, Melody?
Outrage and confronting these people about this absurd attitude they have, and then to go as far as to say that women who endure a rape, which is a violent act against them, should then bear a child if such a child should be conceived under those circumstances. And we know that those who have money will always be able to go somewhere and get an abortion.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for calling in.
Thanks a lot.
Let's hear next from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Wow, so many things go through my mind. First of all, it's embarrassing to say that I've had a number of children aborted from, you know, women that I've impregnated in my life. And maybe it's because there's a lack of education, a lack of knowing any difference. I think this is just a matter of keeping women as second citizens. And also the fact that women aren't supposed to be able to enjoy sex without a big consequence. I think that's a huge deal here.
Well, thank you for calling in, Mark. And you bring up a good questions about sex education, and we'll get some information after we take a few more calls. Let's go to Mark in Redwood City. Hi, Mark.
Hi. My question is more tactical and strategic. It's clear that pro-life is a very positive expression, and a lot of people say, well, of course I'm pro-life. But the pro-lifers aren't really pro-life. They're pro-birth, because as soon as the infant is born, they essentially abandon him or her with depriving social and medical services, etc. And I want to know why the pro-choice people haven't fought back on this labeling level and said, you're not pro-life, you're pro-birth. Tell me how you're pro-life. Tell me where you've supported life. And it's just, to me, a wonder that that the movement hasn't identified this incredible flaw in their morality and in their logic.
Well, thank you for that. Merle, what are your thoughts on that? He's got a good point.
I think he's correct. The caller is correct. The and you notice I keep saying anti-choice. The anti-choice movement has really been a Trojan horse within the pro-choice movement with their language. They have defined the terms of the debate, and that is a big part of the problem. Yes, we have to change our language. We have to call them out on the illogic inconsistencies of their arguments every time they make them. And the misogyny is a major problem, and religion is one dress and one cloak that misogyny wears. You know, they were going to pass a human life amendment years ago, and the idea that a sperm and an egg would have the same rights as I did was outrageous. So why isn't the Barbara Boxer or any of these pro-choice legislators going up and saying, okay, we want to put a bill up on the floor. If you want to make a sperm and an egg a constitutional person, if it's a person at the moment of conception, let it pay taxes, sign it up for the military. I mean, let's get some responsibilities for this thing. I mean, it's a Kafkaesque situation that we're in, and we have to be creative in opposing it in any way possible. But I go back to the point that I think the pro-choice movement is too apologetic. They're too apologetic about their belief system and the morality of our movement.
And Jody, we had another caller, Mark, who was talking about sex education. What do the statistics show about sex education versus abstinence in terms of what's available in schools?
Well, there has been over $1 billion spent on abstinence only until marriage programs in the past decade. And we're poised to see a resurgence of that funding after something of a lull in the first 2 years of the Obama administration. The thing about the funding for abstinence only until marriage programs is that they don't work. So we're literally opening a window and throwing money out the door. You, of course, don't hear anything from the fiscal conservatives about that, but these programs have been time after time after time disproven. The confusion is that comprehensive sex education includes an emphasis on abstaining from sex until you are ready, meaning mature, able to engage only consensually, know, you know, how to protect yourself. So it includes abstaining from sex. That is a major portion of what comprehensive sex ed does. But it also, any good program would teach life negotiation skills about how to protect yourself throughout your life. That includes not only from pregnancy, but also HIV and other STIs or sexually transmitted infections. But politically, you know, even in a Democratic Congress, we had Congress people, who some of whom are no longer in office, but putting money in the hopper for abstinence only until marriage. And that goes back to the links to the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. the inability of pro-choice groups to hold Democrats accountable, mm-hmm. and our, as Merle said, also really our inability to be proactive about our own values and beliefs.
All right. Well, thank you for those calls. And we've got so many more calls. So let's go to Diane in Point Richmond. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I would just piggyback on what the last person spoke about. I had an abortion in the early 1960s. And the reason I had it is because I was absolutely ignorant about birth control. And, you know, we talk about the abortion end of it, but we don't talk about how you get pregnant. And I just can't understand the Republican stance on, you know, abstaining before marriage and not teaching birth control. And, I mean, it just, it makes no sense to me. So thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. Kristen, what are your thoughts on that? And how do Medical Students for Choice deal with the issue of sex education?
Yeah, I think that this issue of education actually extends beyond abstinence-only education to the medical center environment and with residency, where there is a lack of education of providers and of all medical professionals to provide that personalized care. So when I hear about a lack of education of medical students, I automatically think that we are, as a medical community, inhibiting ourselves from being able to provide personalized care to patients, but also being able to empower patients to prevent unplanned pregnancies, and that I find that to be particularly problematic. And then the silence that we hear from physicians and clinicians and students, and the inability to stand up and demand this education and demand the training to be able to provide the care for any patient. A lot of students and clinicians need to be able to do that, and students are doing so by planning their own activities, such as providing those contraception workshops, such as providing workshops on how to perform a safe abortion, and essentially empowering their patients to make decisions that are healthy for them. So we're supplementing the standard curriculum with information that enables people to prevent unplanned pregnancy.
And according to the Guttmacher Institute, 37 states in the country now mandate abstinence education. Kristen, how do you explain the silence? Where does that come from?
To be honest, I think the fallout of that really comes in the fact that you have a number of patients coming into your office not understanding how they got to be in the position that they're in. And I, for example, have seen patients who come in to a provider's office and have, in fact, never had sex but are still pregnant because they don't understand exactly how contraception occurs. Mm. And then they are faced with making a very difficult decision that they're not ready to make and that they wouldn't have to make had they understood what the consequences of certain behaviors were. So physicians are actually in a place, and clinicians as well, and patients are in a place where they have to deal with the unintended consequences that result from a lack of education. So we're not enabling people to make decisions in advance in order to prevent things that they don't want. We're instead dealing with consequences as opposed to being proactive.
Well, thank you for the call, Diane. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number, although our lines are all full, one will become available in just a couple minutes, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our new website, yourcallradio.org, or email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And that's Kristen Ekstrand. She is a student at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine and member of Medical Students for Choice. Merle Hoffman is author of the new book, Intimate Wars, and Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check. And let's go to Phil in Richmond. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, a little experience. When I was a college student, pre-Roe v. Wade, my girlfriend's mother arranged an abortion in Whittier, California. And during the abortion, while my girlfriend was on the table, the place was raided by the police. And they left her on the table for a while because they needed witnesses, they needed photographs, they needed the surgical tools still inserted in her body. And then once that was over, I was forced to come down and testify in a grand jury against the doctors. when I was a young, scared college student at the time. I testified against them, and the fetus was wrapped in a bucket right next to me as I was sitting there testifying before the grand jury. My other my friend of mine, his girlfriend died while she was having the procedure. So it's just, I'm just shaking when I think about it. It goes back that far. So that's the tragedy of not having full access to abortion.
You know, Phil, thank you so much for calling in. How did that experience shape your views on this issue?
Well, I've spoken before rallies before. I joined the ACLU. I just see the tragedy of the blindness of the Christian right, the Catholic Church, the more conservative wing of the Republican Party, not all the Republicans, but most of them. And it just, I just don't understand it, how they can impose their values or lack of unethical values on the rest of us. It's a tragedy.
Well, thank you for calling. A new study just came out by Lancet, and they found that 47,000 women died from unsafe abortions in 2008. Another 8.5 million women had serious medical complications. And Jody, this shouldn't be very surprising, but they also found that abortion rates are higher in countries where the procedure is illegal.
Exactly. Well, because usually that goes hand in hand with lower access to contraception,
right?
And so you have, and also more than likely, a really very low status of women. So women having little control over when and with whom they have sex, and girls getting married very young, you know, by virtue of family pressure and pressure to uphold family honor. So you have a whole range of factors that would play into that.
Well, now I would like to welcome Lori Gregory Garrett to the show. And Lori is calling in from Jackson, Mississippi, where she worked to overturn Initiative 26, which was the so-called personhood initiative in Mississippi. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for waiting on hold there. A lot of people are saying that if personhood cannot pass in Mississippi, one of the most conservative voting blocks in the country, it can't pass anywhere. Talk to us about what went on behind the scenes in Mississippi.
Originally, we were all waiting for the Supreme Court decision to come down. The ACLU had challenged the personhood amendment because we can't make constitutional changes through the amendment process in Mississippi. So we were pretty sure that it wasn't even going to make it on the ballot. The Supreme Court took the stance that since it wasn't on the ballot, it wasn't yet unconstitutional, so they allowed it. And I think we all stood around in shock for about 10 days after that. We did not have a lot of organization here. Planned Parenthood was here, the ACLU was here, but they were had already been demonized by the anti-choice crowd, who had found their website and put up a fake website. Their message was very strong in Mississippi. And we started going door to door. I mean, it was grassroots in its most fundamental. We're standing in front of grocery stores. Mainly, we tried to do rallies and, I'm going to use this term, sweet talk the media into being there, because we knew if we could get our face on television that it was a state, it would go statewide. And that's what we did more and more. We would show up at the Capitol with signs. We would show up places where we knew that we could get news coverage to let people in Mississippi know that it was okay to not be for personhood. Mm. That's almost what we had to tell people. It's okay not to be for personhood. They were told through their churches that in order for Jesus and God to love them and for them to remain pro-life, that personhood had to become a part of our law. Previously on the show, y'all were talking about how comprehensive sex education actually affects ideas regarding abortion. One of the biggest issues that we had in Mississippi was we have no comprehensive sex education in the state.
At all?
None. We only do abstinence here. One of the things that we found is that people do not know how they get pregnant. Mm. And if you do not know how you get pregnant, you cannot explain why personhood is such a load of crap, excuse my French, but why it won't work, why you cannot give rights to a fertilized egg. Because people didn't know that an egg can get fertilized and then, you know, it can miscarry itself and women may not even know. People didn't know the specifics of how a woman's body worked. That was our biggest obstacle. We had to do just some little fundamental sex education stuff with almost every person that we tried to change their opinion on the law so that they could see what would actually happen.
Now, again, this personhood amendment would have defined a fertilized egg as a human being. It lost by 58% in November in Mississippi. I understand that even women who oppose abortion voted against personhood. You had a lot of interactions with women who oppose abortion.
Yes. One of the ideas and statements that we came out with probably 3 weeks before the election that I heard later from other women, Catholic women, pro-life women, that was very helpful to them was we said, you can be pro-life and against personhood. You can live in a culture, a pro-life culture, and be against personhood for the unintended consequences. And that was where we split. Even pro-life women will vote with you when they know that women's lives are at stake because they are pro-life women and they've had babies. And most of them that have had children that were around my age, once you presented that to them, at least one of their friends had had an ectopic pregnancy or had something happen that now the state would be involved in those medical decisions. And, well, if you're a good conservative Republican, which these women are, personhood is big state government. It's not little government. So one of the things I will say that saved us about Mississippi is we do have the fundies here, but we have true conservatives here. And those women and men were able to step back and say, this is not a conservative bill. This is a very big government bill. And people need to say that.
So in the state of Mississippi, there's one clinic in the entire state that provides abortions. And I was in Mississippi a couple of years ago and interviewed some of the doctors there who take different routes home. They wear bulletproof vests to work. They really have no social life because their lives are at risk. And there's no sex education. Mississippi has one of the highest teen pregnancy rates in the country. Based on your experience defeating this personhood amendment, what advice would you give other activists and people who really care about this issue as we're seeing just access being chipped away across the country?
Get the information, the real information, to as many people as you can, as quick as you can. People that are rational, I'm serious, rational people, most of your voting population, despite what you hear, are rational people that like to make good decisions. Get the information to them on what personhood actually does. They have to know about the unintended consequences. We found, and I'm really like 70% of the people that went into it being for personhood. Once we explained to them exactly what it would affect, there would be no birth control. There would be no IVF. Those people changed their minds.
Well, Lori, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
That's Lori Gregory Garrett joining us from Jackson, Mississippi. She worked on the campaign to vote against the personhood amendment in Mississippi, and it lost by 58% in November. And we have just a couple of minutes left, and if you'd like to get in, we've got a couple lines open now. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And just quickly, Jody, it sounds like we really need to go to the grassroots on a more regular basis to find out what's going on and what actually works at the local level.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I think Merle said that earlier, and the other two speakers have also really eloquently talked about that. I absolutely think that's the case. And I think we have to do it proactively, as others have said, not wait till the 11th hour. We've too often lost battles because we haven't done the education up front to make people understand more about what's going on. We already know that there are efforts in many states now for personhood amendments, as an example. We should be out there now cultivating people's understanding, just as they did in Mississippi when they knew it was coming down the pike, about this effort.
All right. Well, let's go to another caller, Summer in San Francisco. Hi, Summer. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just want to say I'm really excited and happy to hear all this talk about being proactive and being visible. I'm a member of an organization in San Francisco in the Bay Area called the Bay Area Coalition for Reproductive Rights. And we actually have a couple of events happening this weekend, and one of them is a rally on Saturday. It's at Justice Herman Plaza from 11 to 1, and it's really going to be a positive, empowering event. We have speakers from the California legislature, from, you know, local politicians, and we also have doctors, and also other ways that people can get involved in making this more of a visible action for women, because I really resonate with the fact that a lot of big groups aren't as supportive when women say they want to get out and they really want to be in the streets. You don't get a lot of support from larger groups that you feel you should get support for that.
And so this rally is this Saturday at 11 o'clock at Justin Herman.
Yeah, and actually on Friday there's a large Occupy event, and we're going to be having a presence there as well.
Right.
Yeah, there's a flash mob, two flash mobs happening, one at noon, one at 5, and there's also a walk to trust women at 6 o'clock at Justin Herman Plaza, and it's to support pro-choice banners that we partnered with an organization called the Silver Ribbon to Trust Women Campaign. And we have, for the first time ever, we have pro-choice banners hanging along Market Street, San Francisco, to promote these events this weekend. So it's very exciting.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Summer.
Thank you.
And we've got just a couple minutes left. One of our listeners, Danielle, says that these men have no intention of doing anything about this issue until they're up for re-election. This is just another needed distraction. And Merle, a lot of people say these guys would never take on Roe. George W. Bush didn't, because they know it's political suicide. But what it does is normalize the extreme language. It moves the Democrats to the right. And then it also gives states the power to enact abortion restrictions, which we're seeing happening across the country. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, after 1973, everybody put their feet up on the desk when the anti-choice movement started to activate and said, oh, it's impossible. They'll never take it away. They'll never do anything. Abortion is legal. I mean, I find myself in the position of being a Cassandra. What I say is we have to occupy the abortion debate. We have to occupy the abortion discussion and the abortion war with pro-choice truth, with our mission and with our values and with our morality. And you cannot sit back and say it's never going to happen, because it's happening. Mm. So we have to be awake and aware and active.
And Jody, brief final thoughts?
I would just agree with Merle. I mean, my take is that at this point, Roe is almost a hindrance in a way, because people are so apathetic in thinking that if Roe is in place, nothing more has to be done. And I really think that we need to be able to change the mindset around that.
And Kristen, brief final thoughts from you?
Oh, no, I would disagree with what everyone else has said, and just say that for people who really care about the issue, to stand up and speak out in some way, shape, or form, whether that is getting involved with education of people or training or wanting to become an abortion provider. Stand up and speak out about these things and fight for your rights.
Well, and we'd love to have a panel of students on. I just want to thank you all for joining us. Kristen Ekstrand is with Medical Students for Choice. According to that group, 80% of all counties and 98% of all rural counties have no abortion providers. Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, and Merle Hoffman is out with a memoir called Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rose.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of taxes and ongoing budget cuts in California. We'll also talk about coverage of President Obama saying no, for now, to the Keystone Pipeline and the mass protests in Nigeria. We'll be joined by the Sacramento Bee's Philip Reese, Mother Jones' Kate Shepard, and freelance journalist Gillian Parker joins us from Nigeria. Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you.